Welcome to Radioactive Magazine. We will be talking with Dr. Sarah Beth Kirk about how people can more effectively cope with trauma and conflict. Dr. Kirk is director of the psychological clinic at the University of Kansas and associate director of their clinical psychology program. She is particularly interested in evidence-based treatments using data to improve the quality of the therapy they offer. This includes pursuing anti-racism and diversity, equity, and inclusion goals while evaluating the alternative assessment tools and psychological approaches. This also includes altering or abandoning many traditional approaches with racist and sexist roots. Dr. Kirk has received multiple awards at KU for excellence in teaching and mentoring, promoting gender and racial equity. I'm Spencer Graves. Carl Brooks is helping with this interview. So, what are the most important things you would like to communicate to our audience?
I guess I can just start with, since we're going to be talking about coping with trauma and conflict today, I would say, you know, approaching this with just kindness and consideration. And certainly in psychology, this is an ever increasing need in our field in terms of how to address, because we see the needs of the public increasing, and particularly since COVID-19.
Well, that's interesting. What is evidence-based treatment?
Sure. So evidence-based treatment, we call it in our field a three-legged stool approach. And that means there's three legs that kind of prop this up. One of those legs, and the most important leg, in my opinion, is the person that's receiving treatment. And when you're considering that person and what treatment you're going to use with them, you have to think about lots of variables. It could be things about them. It could be, for example, sex and gender. It could be sexuality. It could be ethnicity, race. It could be their family of origin, many other cultural variables. It could be individual variables, things like their level of intellectual ability or development. So there's lots of things that the person's going to bring to the table that you have to consider before you apply a treatment. And I think it's probably the most important. Second is what the therapist or the psychologist brings to the table, because one might have training in different types of treatments or assessments, or be stronger in certain areas. And so they're going to bring a certain level of training and understanding to the situation as well. So, for example, in evidence-based practice, I might be trained in several different evidence-based treatments, but I might not be trained in another. So that's going to affect the selection. Also, there might just be personal fit. So there might be different types of treatment that I am just drawn to, and I tend to get trained in and make sure that I understand and can apply those treatments well. So that's just kind of a personal variable as well. And also, similar to the person in treatment, I bring personal variables, you know, again, my sex, my gender, my race, my ethnicity, my family of origin, and those cultural variables are also in the mix in effect treatment. And then the third piece, which I think people hear evidence and they think this is the only piece, but it's just one piece of the puzzle, is the actual evidence or empirical evidence. And that is, do we have a treatment that has good scientific evidence or backing, and that we know will work with a given person or population?
Right.
That would be what I would say.
So how do you compile that evidence? I mean,
that's a very good question.
Or what?
So one thing is certainly through research. So as a clinical psychologist, one of the things, fortunately, that I'm trained in is research. So one thing is just conducting research whenever you're going to be using a particular treatment or approach. Second is we get continuing education. So licensed psychologists, we're required to get continuing education. So we're consistently over time getting We were gathering evidence about what we're using and utilizing, and then also discarding treatments if they no longer have a strong evidence base. So we're doing our own personal education research throughout the time that we're practicing. Certainly, our educational background contributes to that as well. That's where we learn a lot of those empirically based treatment is early in our training. But I've been out, 25 years. I have to continue to get that training through continuing education. I can't just rest on what happened 25 years ago because some of that no longer has a strong evidence base.
So, not, forgive me for hammering on this point, but what is research?
Sure. So research really is where folks are conducting trials. So they're conducting research with folks out there that are struggling with mental health presentations. And if we're talking about trauma and conflict, we might just say those that have suffered trauma. So you look at gathering information and data about those individuals, how they've managed it, how they've approached it, and then what treatments seem to work with them. So, for example, that might be having people that have had trauma be involved in treatment A and then comparing it to folks that are on a wait list, gathering evidence, then does that treatment help them more than just sitting on a wait list?
If you're going to make an intervention, it would seem to me that you have to wait until sometime after the intervention to evaluate its effectiveness.
So, when it comes to intervention and psychology research in general, most dissemination of research, for example, on an intervention to really say, yep, we're getting to a point where we can say that this is effective is at least 10 years out, at least, because it takes time to amass that evidence. Now, again, you can get lots of different points of evidence. But there is what we call empirically supported treatments in psychology. And that means they kind of meet a gold standard. They've been caught, they've been compared to control groups. There's been evidence gathered over time. There's multiple studies that have confirmed or supported the evidence. You're not done after 10 years either. You have to continue to gather research on treatment as well. People change. I mean, our times have changed. So what may have worked really well, for example, in the 1970s, it might look really different today.
When you're talking about insurance and you're talking about budget responses, I suppose the insurance companies and the state of Kansas that approves your budget and so forth, they like to see the research, right?
Yes. Yeah, they want to see that we're engaged in evidence-based practice. And researchers in particular, research is very important in terms of using evidence-based practice with a lot of insurance carriers, showing that this works better than just sitting on a wait list or what we call treatment as usual, which might be something that's generic or doesn't have the specificity that a particular treatment does.
Carl?
Sarah, if you've looked at the research that's been done, let's say over the past 5 years on trauma, just in North America, what are some of the headlines that might come out to a non-specialist audience from that research about trauma and its psychological impacts?
And one thing too, I just want to be very clear. I'm not an expert on trauma research. I'm a director of a clinic, mental health clinic. I do try to keep up as best as I can, but I just want to be very clear about that. So I think one thing is over time, what I think the field has really done is we've said that we have to expand beyond just, for example, addressing post-traumatic stress disorder. So post-traumatic stress disorder is a psychological disorder. It's a diagnosable condition. And some people that go through trauma may develop that particular condition. There are many people that may experience trauma that do not develop that condition. And I think one thing that's really changed over time is let's expand our research to really look at everything on the continuum, from folks that have been through trauma, what's helpful to them, in the immediate aftermath or, as things continue for them. And depending on what's happening with them, maybe it's folks that have developed post-traumatic stress disorder or acute stress conditions. Maybe it's folks that are having more physical health problems. Maybe it's folks that are having just more mild presentation or concerns? And how can we really support them as a mental health community kind of across that continuum? I think that's one thing, you know, that we've become more responsive and it's not just about one category. That category is really important too, post-traumatic stress disorder. And I think one thing that's happened in that field is it's moved over time. Whereas, you know, at one point it started out firmly kind of in the camp of individuals that had experienced war or battle. You know, it really started out with veterans, and then it moved into other areas. Certainly sexual assault is another area where there's quite a bit of research. And also considering all the different types of things that could be traumatic for folks that are beyond those two categories, you know, motor vehicle accidents, going through COVID-19, you know, experiencing gun violence.
Is it fair to say that trauma is typically presented by an individual, or can trauma be presented and experienced by a group of any size? 20 people in a neighborhood who witness a crime, 1,000 people in a community who hear of some terrible occurrence in that community?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things. One is certainly it might be that we're understanding that presentation from an individual, and they might be part of a group. So it could be that both are true. But again, to assume that one person's experience within a group is going to be exactly the same as another person's in the group would, I think, be inaccurate. Now, to say that a group, particularly if they are an oppressed group, a group that's, like you said, experiencing that trauma, that they don't all experience trauma would also be inaccurate because they may, as a group, as an entity. But again, you do want to think about the individual differences because, again, everybody's individual makeup may make them more or less prone to the impact of that trauma.
How does therapy for a trauma victim differ from other kinds of psychological conditions?
So again, trauma can be used in lots of different ways, and some individuals suffer trauma. And so, Spencer, they might have depression, they might have anxiety, they may not have post-traumatic stress disorder. So it kind of depends on their presenting concern. So trauma may be an experience they have, but their presenting concerns could differ a lot. They could, like I said, have kind of a myriad of symptoms. If you're asking me about post-traumatic stress disorder, which is more specific because it's a specific diagnostic criteria that people have met, then those individuals, for example, there's two treatments that have been had a lot of empirical evidence to support their use. One is called prolonged exposure. The other one is called cognitive processing therapy. These are evidence-based practices that have been utilized in the Veterans Administration hospitals for many years now. They're also used with, again, lots of folks that have post-traumatic stress disorder, something we certainly use in our psychological clinic. So those are two treatments, for example, that are very helpful and beneficial. But do they work with every person with post-traumatic stress disorder? They do not. You know, we know that they work with a lot of people with post-traumatic stress disorder and can be quite helpful, but sometimes it's not a match for a particular individual. So again, as I said, with that three-legged stool, we have to kind of consider the individual and what they bring to us.
So how do you tell when it's not a match and decide to change, you need to change
That's right.
your
So I think about, I mean, from a psychology, you know, we're always evaluating and trying to understand what's happening with the person in front of us. And we're taking that data in every session, within session, between session. So, for example, Spencer, if someone is too distressed to go through some of the treatment steps that are necessary in those treatments, and we know they're just not ready. That's not where they are right now. We might be stepping back and maybe doing something different. Maybe we're doing something like going through some mindfulness-based training or going through something else that just kind of helps them stabilize, maybe just manage their stress or distress more effectively.
There's the diagnostical and statistical manual, and how does that play into what we're talking about here?
Sure. So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, now in its fifth version, and actually it's received an update. So it's kind of in it's actually got an additional, a few alterations made to it as well. So that's what we use along to really make diagnoses. So when I talked about post-traumatic stress disorder, that's one of the diagnoses that's in that manual. That should, in some ways, guide our treatment, but there are also things that cut across diagnostic categories. So we have in psychology what's called transdiagnostic treatments. One of them is called the Unified Protocol, just as an example. And what it does is it pulls from several different evidence-based practices or treatments, and it pulls it together, and it brings different parts of different treatments together for a single person. And the argument is that the DSM-5 is it's fallible, in that using a categorical approach doesn't necessarily work for everyone, and more of a continuum approach might be more beneficial, or a transdiagnostic classification system. That's an argument for another interview in another day, but there certainly it is in play or abound in psychology right now. So some of these transdiagnostic treatments actually say, let's see what this person is presenting with. Maybe they have a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and we're going to treat what they're presenting with instead of trying to pigeonhole them or put them into a category.
Right. We are visiting with Dr. Sarah Beth Kirk about how people can more effectively cope with trauma and conflict. So did I ask this? How does psychology of trauma and conflict differ from other psychological conditions?
It doesn't necessarily differ in that, like I said, some people can have symptom presentations from lots of categories: anxiety, depression, even eating difficulties, sleep difficulties, if they have trauma. So it can kind of cut across a lot of different psychological conditions: insomnia, eating disorders, anxiety, depression.
Sarah, let me ask you, you mentioned a couple times COVID being a very large event that went on for a long time that affected essentially every person in the United States or around the world. If you think about traumatic impacts of COVID on, let's say, groups of Americans, are there layers of people who have experienced more trauma because of the COVID experience? I'm thinking, for example, of first responders, medical professionals, and then are there diminishing layers as you go further away from those who are on this front line, so to speak.
Well, and I guess I hear what you're saying, and I don't talk about it in those terms because one thing that we know from trauma is, like, for example, people can experience vicarious trauma. They can experience in-person trauma. And so one person's trauma may just look really different from another person's trauma. I would agree with you. I think our first responders have had it really rough. I would say to in my opinion, they're in a category that has just experienced, like you said, a significant level of trauma. And I am sure there are some individuals within those responders that may, describe that differently. So I just don't want to kind of impress myself on their experience. I would say when we hear from our patients, whether it's first responders, treatment providers, but it cuts across a lot of categories, teachers that were just, trying so hard to and feeling terrible about, how their students are doing, how they're trying to survive and teach and raise their own children, all sorts of experiences. Also, just folks that had terrible COVID, long COVID, really severe COVID, multiple people in their family affected with COVID. We've talked to lots of patients that lost family members during COVID. They weren't even able to see them or visit them. Just really significant challenges. So Carl, I would say it kind of hits so many points, whether it was your own individual spirits with the illness. Yeah, Spencer.
So, what about individual versus group therapy?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know of any particular research that puts them head to head, but we do know that a lot of group treatment is used, particularly, in the VA systems, with folks that have experienced trauma, also with sexual assault victims. And one thing we just know about group therapy in general is that it can be helpful and beneficial to hear and process emotions and experiences with other people that may have some level of shared experience with you. My experience, Spencer, is that it's to each their own. You know, I do have definitely some patients that present that say, I do not want to be in a group. Group treatment's not for me. Others really love it.
Does the KU Psychological Center, are you just serving students and or students and staff of KU or the public at large or?
We serve the public at large and KU staff and faculty and students. So we kind of do it all. We do telemental health services. We conduct telemental health services. We actually put that fully into practice during COVID. We immediately flipped because we had to. And we've kept that practice going, which I think is true of a lot of places. You know, a lot of places were not necessarily doing telemental health. Now, kind of everyone is, at some level. I think hybrid has really been probably the best practice for us of being able to do both, because we definitely have patients that prefer one or the other. We have patients that need to flip back and forth at times, whether it's health reasons, accessibility. I think it's a wonderful addition to our menu of services. And I like that we do both. Yeah, Carl.
Sarah, the word trauma has become used and probably overused. I'm sure that specialists like you are delighted that people are thinking about it and talking about it, but concerned that it bounces through mass media, politics, and culture in ways that aren't super helpful. If you had to think about, let's say, public officials, public voices who've been speaking productively and helpfully about trauma, can you identify some of those? And by the same contrast, are there discussions of trauma in the public sphere that worry you because they're inaccurate or unhelpful?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. Again, it's one of those things where it can be real tricky because I think what is trauma to one person may not look like that for another. But I think what's not helpful, I guess, is the most easy way to talk about this, Carl, is maligning or being hateful to others because of their experiences. Because why is that necessary? Or and it's certainly not helpful. So perhaps Spencer experiences something and he says that was traumatic for me, and I have a different experience. That's okay that Spencer had that experience. I don't need to attack him for that perception or that experience. That's unnecessarily and unhelpful. If you ask me, who do I think has done a bad job or a good job? I really don't like to just, honestly, insult others, particularly in a public sphere. But when I think about, wow, I really kind of appreciated how they've talked about that. One thing that I really enjoy listening to, even though I don't live in Kansas City, but I used to work there, so I like to listen to some of the Kansas City press, is I really enjoy the interviews with Mayor Lucas. I just think he does a wonderful job of describing, how Kansas City is responding, first responders. I've just really enjoyed some of those interviews and how he's spoken about trauma in a public sphere. I think he does so in a caring, open, supportive way. And it's about kind of bringing people together. And supporting one another's and particularly the communities in Kansas City. So I would just say that shout out to him.
Obviously, you haven't had much time to, you haven't had a decade of to evaluate the relative effectiveness of telemental health services, but I assume you've got at least a couple of years of in the research now, or is it?
Well, there's been research though conducted on telehealth before COVID. And honestly, those results are pretty encouraging. There have been some head-to-head comparison of in-person to telehealth, particularly in the area of evidence-based practice. And they've really shown pretty strong, comparisons that they can be approximately the same. What I do know, Spencer, at least in terms of our what I would call this is more anecdotal because I haven't analyzed the data, but in our clinic, we found it works well for some folks. It doesn't work well for others. And so there, especially I found with some of our, and again, we're not running a child and family clinic, so I would want you to talk to a child person about their experiences. But with some of our kiddos that we were trying to connect with on telemental health, it just wasn't working. It just did so much better when we had them here in person. So that's one population that it seems to me, again, not all, but I think there might be some children where it just works better in person, depending on what the modality of treatment is. But also for our adults. adults. We just had folks that were like, I want to get back in there. We have a lot of people that just love coming here. We're part of their community. They love to talk to the secretarial staff and have a cup of coffee and talk to us. I mean, they just like the community of coming here. So, but telehealth is great. If somebody's ill, if somebody had a flat tire, if they can't get to us from Kansas City because they don't have any transportation, it just works great for them.
So thinking about military and former military and medical personnel who served in combat situations and so forth. Palestinian, I'm thinking for your Palestinian American Medical Association and people who managed to deliver help in Gaza under the current situation. Any comments on that?
Well, I just think what we've been talking about here, whenever we work with veterans, individuals that have experienced conflicts, again, their trauma is their trauma. All of those experiences could be highly traumatic for folks. And then we're going to treat that again in the way that they present to us. Maybe it's post-traumatic stress disorder. Maybe it's difficulty sleeping, eating. We're going to address what they're presenting with. But all of those could be situations, again, where folks have expressed that they've experienced trauma, and some have elevated to post-traumatic stress disorder.
Carl?
Sarah, if you had to think about recommendations to people who are involved in formulating public policy about healthcare, should psychological services, especially those that are oriented toward trauma care, play a bigger role in health services that are available? Should we invest more, put more muscle behind it?
Absolutely, 100%. Anything that we can do to improve mental health services, I think, is necessary and important. One of the things that I've been involved with on the Kansas side is just talking about is mental health parity really working? Some of the mental health parity laws, and there's a lot of discussion around that. It sounds like a good thing, but we really haven't achieved it. And I would agree with that. So, for example, can you get mental health care just as easy as you can get diabetes care? No. Because again, Carl, the access points for mental health care, telehealth is helped for sure, whether it's rural or other areas that are, again, have a really high demand for services. But we always need more funding for mental health services.
Just to play the devil's advocate about more money, okay? There's probably some optimal level, all right, of funding that we're pretty much below that optimal level now. But how would you, does the research tell you anything about what ought to be an optimal level of funding for?
That I don't know, and it's definitely just not my area of expertise in terms of economics and the economics of behavioral health care. I don't know. I don't know what that number may be, but I can tell you, I don't know a single person in mental health research or clinical practice that would say that we're at an optimal level of funding for any of those things.
We have been talking with Dr. Sarah Beth Kirk about how people can more effectively cope with trauma and conflict. Dr. Kirk is director of the Psychological Clinic at the University of Kansas and associate director of their clinical psychology program. Carl Brooks has helped with this interview. I'm Spencer Graves. Thank you for listening.